major axes of advance on a 1,000-kilometer front from Karelia in the south to Petsamo in the north. Within days, it would all be over. To face this onslaught, Finland had managed to mobilize about 180,000 men, organized into 8 infantry divisions and a number of independent battalions. The main strength was concentrated on the Karelian Isthmus, where 6 divisions of 2 corps took up defensive positions along the Mannerheim line. To the north of Lake Ladoga, manning a line of about 100 kilometers, were another 2 divisions, organized into another corps. The remaining 1,000 kilometers to the Arctic Sea was covered by the North Finland Group, a collection of civic guards, border guards, and activated reservists. Finnish commanders were to experience 2 very different types of combat: a grinding, attritional defensive battle in the Karelian Isthmus, and a war of rapid maneuver and sudden ambush north of Lake Ladoga. Mannerheim's commanders at the operational level in Karelia were General Hugo Oesterman, commander of the Army of the Karelian Isthmus, and his corps commanders, General Harold Ulkvist, who commanded 2nd Corps, and General Erik Heinrichs, who commanded 3rd Corps. They were intelligent officers, capable of highly flexible responses to difficult situations, but they lacked experience. The men disagreed with Mannerheim's argument for a layered defense of the Karelian Isthmus, and were much more enthusiastic about launching a counteroffensive when the initial Soviet thrust had been blunted. The Jaeger tradition of Finnish officers was put into practice in the forest fighting north of Lake Ladoga. Here, the heroes of a guerrilla war on skis emerged to capture the popular imagination, not just of Finland, but of virtually the entire world. Men like business executive Paavo Talvela, the prominent lawyer Hjalmar Stalasbuo, and the rabble-rousing right-wing politician Kurt Wallenius led their forces with a flair and a dash completely foreign to the Soviet army of that time. At least one famed Finnish ski commander, Kurt Wallenius, discovered that he couldn't take the pressure. Appointed to command a hastily formed reserve on the Mannerheim line in late February, he immediately took to the bottle to steady his nerves and stayed drunk for 3 days. On the 3rd of March, Mannerheim relieved him of command. The Finns knew that in any war with the USSR, they would be on the defensive, but they vowed that it should be an active defense. They were light on firepower, but very good in terms of mobility and lower-level tactics. The forest itself dictated a heavy emphasis on individual initiative and small unit operations, quasi-guerrilla style. Marksmanship, mental agility, woodcraft, orienteering, camouflage and physical fitness were stressed, and parade ground complements were discouraged. Unconventional tactics, ambushes, long-range patrols, deceptions, raids were enshrined as doctrine and refined. The Finns intended to absorb the first Soviet strikes, delay the enemy, let him wear himself down, and then counterattack. Just after dawn, on the 30th of November 1939, Russian SB-2 medium bombers attacked strategic points in Helsinki, killing 200 on the first day of the war. Over the next 48 hours, reports poured into Mannerheim's HQ of Soviet attacks from the Gulf of Finland in the south to the Arctic coast. In Finland's far north, elements of the White Sea Fleet bombarded Finn positions on the Rajbachi Peninsula. Shortly afterwards, troops of the Soviet 104th Division stormed ashore. Faced with overwhelming odds, the Finns pulled back south along the Arctic Highway, abandoning the port of Petsamo. There was no alternative. Mannerheim knew that any attempt to hold the port would result in a siege, and he had no way of keeping the garrison supplied. On the 1st of December, the Soviet cruiser Kirov and 2 large destroyers opened fire on Finnish fortifications at Hanko on the Gulf of Finland. Finnish coastal batteries remained silent until the Russian ships were within range, and then loosed a salvo. They scored a direct hit on one of the destroyers, which put about abruptly and limped out of range behind a smoke screen. Finnish batteries then straddled Kirov, with at least one shell smashing into the engine room. Losing power rapidly, Kirov withdrew from action as fast as she could and was towed back to Kronstadt. On land, the Finns were doing less well. As Mannerheim thought, the main Soviet offensive thrust came up the Karelian Isthmus. It was here, on a front of some 80 kilometres, that Meretskov had concentrated 120,000 troops, supported by 1,000 tanks. Directly in front of the main defensive line, Mannerheim had created a buffer zone, some 20 to 45 kilometres deep, in which villages had been razed and booby-trapped, and mines had been planted. About 21,000 Finnish soldiers held strong points in this zone, their role to break up and disorganise Soviet formations before they reached the main defensive positions. In some places, this strategy worked. On the southwest coast, the Soviets ran into determined resistance before the village of Teridjoki, where Finnish companies counterattacked during the night of the 30th of November, 1st of December, and succeeded in retaking lost positions. But elsewhere, Finnish forces abandoned positions, sometimes on the merest rumour that the Russians were approaching. On the 4th of December, a furious Mannerheim stormed into General Oesterman's HQ, demanding that the forces in the buffer zone offer firmer resistance to the Soviet advance. Oesterman, who regarded the buffer zone policy as too risky for Finland's semi-trained troops, offered his resignation, which Mannerheim refused to accept. Had the Soviets reached the Mannerheim line at this time, they may have triggered a major crisis in the Finnish ranks. But the Russians advanced sluggishly, their massive mechanized columns immobilized for hours at a time in huge traffic jams. It was not until the 6th of December that Soviet forward units reached the line, and not until the 8th of December that artillery and ammunition had been brought forward in significant quantities. By this time, Mannerheim was receiving alarming reports from all along Finland's 1,000-kilometre frontier with the USSR north of Lake Ladoga. A fairly developed road and rail system ran along the northern shore of the lake, and along this advanced three Soviet divisions, far more than Mannerheim had thought the Soviets could logistically sustain. Here, there was no defence line. The defending troops, Finland's 4th Corps, too weak to hold ground, had to rely on a mobile defence. Finnish sappers blew up a dam on Lake Suojärvi, about 16 kilometres northeast of Ladoga, which flooded the Soviets' main line of advance for a few hours before the water froze. On the 3rd of December, the Finns attempted a counterattack, but the sudden appearance of Russian tanks stopped them in their tracks. They disengaged hurriedly and withdrew to the western bank of the Aitujaki River. The next day, the Soviets crossed in strength, pushing the Finns back to the road junction at Tolvajärvi, from where it was possible that the Soviets might come around the north of Lake Ladoga and take the Mannerheim line from the rear. Further north still, the Soviet 163rd and 44th Divisions ground along tracks and logging roads towards the main north-south highway junction at Suomussalmi, a town with a peacetime population of about 4,000. So certain was Mannerheim that the Soviets would not be able to operate in such a remote area that he had deployed only a few companies of border guards. The Soviets pushed them aside with ease. On the 7th of December, Soviet columns rolled into the straggling streets of Suomussalmi. From here, the Soviets were poised to advance west across the narrow waste of Finland and cut the country in half. With the exception of a naval reversal off Hanko, the first week of operations had gone well for the Soviets. It seemed that another week would secure victory. They were so confident, they established a new government in one of the villages they had liberated in the Karelian Isthmus, a government which was sure to be in Helsinki in the very near future. Thank you. Helsinki by the end of the first week, many members of the government and several quite senior soldiers were close to despair. A younger, less experienced commander might well have succumbed to panic. But this was Mannerheim's fifth war, and he reviewed the growing crisis with icy calm. He'd been surprised by the sheer extent of the Soviet thrusts, but he knew that so many over such long distances would stretch Soviet logistics. Although Finnish forces everywhere had been driven back, a Soviet breakthrough had not been achieved. Mannerheim took prompt action. The commanding officer of 4th Corps, who'd been unable to prevent a near disaster north of Lake Ladoga, he replaced with Major General Woldemar Haglund, a veteran of the 27th Jaegers. He also redeployed his scarce resources, sending reinforcements to 4th Corps north of Lake Ladoga and to Suomussalmi. But he kept most of his reserves concentrated on the Karelian Isthmus. Finland could afford to give ground anywhere but there. On the Karelian front, Merezkov knew that the Finns would concentrate their forces on the central west of the Mannerheim line at Suma, where a developed road and rail system ran northwest to Viipuri and then on to Helsinki. So he decided to attack first on the Finns' eastern flank, near the village of Taipale, where the Mannerheim line met Lake Ladoga. Enough pressure here, Merezkov reasoned, would persuade the Finns to commit their reserves, at which point the Soviets would strike at Suma. The first Russian probes crossed the Taipale River on the 6th of December and found the far bank apparently undefended. More battalions rushed forward to exploit what seemed to be a gap in the Mannerheim line. However, all was not as it seemed. The hapless Russians advanced into a carefully prepared killing ground, covered by Finnish artillery and machine guns. The first waves of Russians were cut down in a torrent of fire. To the amazement of the Finns, the Russians kept pouring units into what was clearly a trap. They failed to understand Merezkov's strategy, which was to accept high casualties in order to engage the Finns in an attritional battle and draw their strength away from Suma. Before dawn on the 14th of December, massed Soviet artillery opened up its first major bombardment of the war. At 11:30, the barrage lifted. Soviet tanks, accompanied by infantry in closely packed groups, moved forward. The Finns waited until the Russians reached pre-plotted firing lines and then opened up. Shrapnel tore through the dense masses of Soviet infantry, while tank after tank was hit. It took just 5 minutes to bring the Soviet attack to a halt and then send it staggering into retreat. Merezkov fed another two divisions into the battle and reinforced the artillery to 84 batteries. Although he had hoped for a breakthrough, he believed that the fighting was now of such intensity that it must have absorbed the Finnish reserve. That being so, it was time to alter the axis of attack. At 0500 on the 17th of December, Merezkov launched his main offensive against the Mannerheim line at Suma. Massed Soviet artillery opened up, and for 5 hours worked its way backwards and forwards across the Finnish positions. It was the heaviest artillery bombardment experienced anywhere in the world since those on the Western Front at the beginning of November 1918. Moving along corridors left untouched by the artillery, Soviet sappers swarmed forward, attempting to lift mines and clear obstacles. Behind them rumbled the tanks, accompanied at first by clumps of Russian infantry. But infantry and armor cooperation was poor. As the tanks pushed forward, the infantry were left behind, leaving gaps. Spotting their chance to exploit this weakness, Finnish machine gunners and mortar teams opened up on the infantry. The tanks rolled on alone to the line of granite anti-tank obstacles. their tracks biting into the rock monoliths and pushing the tanks skyward at a steep angle. At this point, the Finnish anti-tank teams struck. In some places, the crew of a Bofors 37mm anti-tank gun managed to get their solid 2-pound shells directly into the vulnerable bellies of the tanks, smashing the transmission or killing some of the crew. At many points in the Suomi sector, the Mannerheim line was flanked by lakes, which were now frozen solid. As his frontal assaults against the line ground to a halt, Mieretzkov sent columns directly across the lakes in the hope of outflanking the main defences. But the shores of the lakes were made up of jumbles of granite boulders, cliffs and dense forests. There were only a handful of exits from most lakes which channeled the Russian advance. With carefully placed anti-tank guns and ambush parties, these exits were turned into killing grounds. By the 19th of December, Mieretzkov was becoming desperate. He had promised Stalin victory for his birthday on the 21st of December. While closely packed battalions were marched over minefields, clearing them with their own bodies, the KV tank was sent into action for the first time. A squadron of these 47-ton monsters managed to smash its way through part of the Mannerheim line and into the streets of the village of Suomi. But the threatened breakthrough was quickly sealed off. Finnish infantry swarmed over the roofs of the houses, jumped onto the tops of the tanks, and fired their Suomis through the driver's vision slit, while others drenched the KVs with Molotov cocktails. On the 20th of December, Mieretzkov's armoured commanders reported that the assault on the Mannerheim line had cost 250 armoured vehicles, most of which had been lost in the fighting around Suomi. Casualties, too, had been horrific. As General Oesterman surveyed the battlefield through his binoculars, the sight of dozens of burnt-out Soviet tanks and dark piles of dead Russian infantry convinced him that the time had come for a counterattack. Mannerheim was much more cautious, but he too seems to have been carried away by a new infectious spirit of optimism. At 06:30 on the 23rd of December, Finnish artillery opened up for a 10-minute barrage, behind which three Finnish divisions, the 1st, 4th and 6th, advanced towards the Russians. They overran Russian outposts with relative ease, but as they advanced, Russian resistance increased. Faced with an increasingly resolute Soviet defence, the Finnish divisions began to collapse into a huge, ungainly mob, unresponsive to the commands of the officers. Realising that he had a first-class debacle on his hands, Mannerheim called off the attack. The Finns lost 1,500 men on the 23rd of December, a salutary reminder of the cost of such operations. Elsewhere, however, lightly equipped semi-trained Finnish forces were beginning to strike back at Soviet columns. In the forest vastness north of Lake Ladoga, battalions of white-clad ski troops could move rapidly around the flanks of Soviet columns, striking them from unexpected directions. From these guerrilla pinpricks, a series of increasingly impressive counterattacks began to emerge. They began immediately north of Ladoga, in the area of Tolvajärvi and Ilomantsi. On Finnish Independence Day, the 6th of December, when Finnish fortunes seemed to hit rock bottom, Colonel Paavo Talvela, an old friend of Mannerheim's, reported to the Marshal's HQ at Mikkel. Mannerheim was brief and to the point. All Finnish forces in the Tolvajärvi-Ilomantsi corridor were henceforth designated Group Talvela. The colonel was to drive north and stabilise the situation. But this was easier said than done. When Talvela reached the front later that day, he found the Finns frightened, demoralised, and getting ready to retreat once again. Talvela realised that something had to be done quickly, in case the entire defence north of Ladoga collapsed. The best way of restoring their confidence, Talvela reasoned, was to give them a quick victory. Displaying a boldness that verged on the reckless, Talvola selected a few companies who seemed to be coping better than the rest, and just before midnight sent them across the ice of Lake Tolvoyavi to raid Russian bivouacs. By 0200 on the 7th of December, 140 Finns, whose weapons included 16 light machine guns, lay spread out along a low ridge, looking down into a Russian battalion encamped around blazing fires. Rarely have troops been presented with such clear and easy targets. The Finns opened fire. A withering barrage cut through the Russian ranks for 4 minutes, reducing the clumps of men to forlorn heaps. When they stopped, there was no movement. The entire battalion had been wiped out. Russian units to the left and right flanks began firing wildly, and then at each other. The Finns slipped back across the ice to the sounds of an ever more ferocious battle, as the Russians killed each other. News of the success of the raid reinvigorated the Finns. The following day, on the 8th of December, a force operating to the north under Colonel Pär Elkholm ambushed and annihilated a Russian battalion as it attempted to find its way out of a frozen bog. With success like this, Talvola felt confident enough to order a general counterattack. For the next 2 days, the Finns kept attacking along the flanks of the strung-out Russian units. The temperature was now minus 25 degrees. The snowdrifts were deep and solid, and the Russians had no skis. As the Finns swept around them, the Russians tried to hit back with tactical airstrikes, which helped Soviet morale but had little chance of locating their well-camouflaged enemy. Late on the 21st of December, two companies of Finns crossed the ice of Lake Tolvoyavi to attack the village of Olgoyavi from the north. Two companies attacked from the south. The Russians had turned each building into a strong point, and every one had to be destroyed in turn with grenades, Molotov cocktails, and satchel charges. It was a bloody and exhausting business, but by 1400 hours, the Russians were in retreat. The Finns pressed on for 2 more days, reaching the Aitojoki River on the 23rd of December, when Mannerheim called off the attack. Since the beginning of the offensive on the 7th of December, Talvola's force of 6,000 men had suffered 2,000 casualties, of whom 630 had been killed. The Finns counted more than 4,000 Russian bodies, and estimated that at least another 5,000 had been wounded, of whom some 600 had become prisoners. Further south, along the northern shore of Lake Ladoga, General Haglund launched a counteroffensive against the Soviet 168th Division, which was spread out along dozens of kilometres of snowbound road. As Finnish ski troops swept around the Russian flanks, chopping into the columns in elongated pockets, the Russian troops deployed for all-round defence and began digging in. By the second week in January, Russian columns had been cut into 11 pockets, known to the Finns as motis. Haglund barely had enough men to maintain a permanent presence at each moti, and instead conducted a mobile siege, with ski troops keeping the Russians off balance through a series of hit-and-run attacks. Most motis were too powerful to attack directly. They contained scores of tanks, hundreds of guns, and the men could survive for a time by eating their horses and by supply drops from the Soviet Air Force. The Finns set up anti-aircraft guns around the motis and sometimes succeeded in duplicating Russian signals requesting logistic drops so that the supplies came floating down to their own rather than the Soviet positions. The Russians attempted to supplement the airdrop by bringing in supplies across Lake Ladoga at night, but these columns were frequently ambushed by Finnish ski patrols. As Soviet supplies dwindled, pocket after pocket was faced with the choice of surrendering to the Finns or attempting to break out. Invariably, they chose the latter course. The 3,600 Russians inside the East Lameti Moti came charging out in mid-January, hoping to overwhelm the single battalion besieging them, but ran into withering machine gun fire. After the massacre, the Finns counted more than 3,000 Russian dead, including a Soviet general who was surrounded by the bodies of 4 female typists, each clutching a rifle. By the end of January, 8 of the 11 Motis along the northern shore of Lake Ladoga had fallen to General Haglund's forces. During December, the news from Finland had been greeted in the Kremlin with disquiet, then alarm, and finally rage. In late December, Stalin met with his military chiefs. The Soviet leader was painfully aware that the world was comparing his own failure to defeat Finland with Hitler's rapid destruction of Poland 3 months earlier. He ordered the execution of some of the officers who had failed, but there was to be no wholesale bloodletting. Stalin knew that the poor performance of the Soviet army was partly due to his own purge of senior and middle-ranking officers. He was a survivor, and his response to the crisis was pragmatic. The Leningrad military district that had been conducting the campaign was reorganized and became the Northwestern Army Group, or Front. To command at the operational level, Stalin chose General Semyon Konstantinovich Timoshenko, a former barrel maker, who had proved an effective army commander in the short Polish campaign. Timoshenko's first step was to reorganize the Northwestern Front, creating two armies, 7th and 14th. Once he established a new command structure, he moved in fresh divisions. Like Merezkov before him, he identified a 16-kilometer-wide corridor at Suma as the best place to effect a breakthrough. Here, he assembled 10 infantry divisions, 5 tank brigades, and 2,800 guns, enough artillery to give him a front-wide ratio of 50 guns per kilometre. During the last weeks of January, Soviet patrols probed the Mannerheim line, identifying the location of bunkers, and even bringing back pieces of concrete for analysis. On the 1st of February, Northwestern Front's artillery opened up, pumping 300,000 shells into Finnish positions in the first 24 hours. In the Suma sector alone, 400 shells per minute rained on Finnish positions. Under this crushing bombardment, some of the Finnish fortifications began to crumble. By the 10th of February, the Soviets were attacking all along the line, forcing the Finns into a battle of attrition they could not win. To the alarm of the defenders, Finnish batteries were no longer responding to Russian shelling. The Finns were running out of ammunition, and battery commanders were now under strict orders not to fire, except in cases of dire emergency. Finnish soldiers watched with frustration as masses of Russian infantry deployed to their front, and their guns remained silent. They now had to rely on machine guns, rifles and mortars to prevent a breakthrough. But still, the Mannerheim line held. The Russians attempted to outflank the line by sending columns across the ice of the Gulf of Finland and Lake Ladoga. Finnish coastal batteries sent armor-piercing shells smashing into the frozen surface. Airbursts of shrapnel tore through the Soviet ranks, pushing them to flee across the fractured ice, where many hundreds drowned. On the 12th of February, a thick fog blanketed the Gulf of Finland. The Russians, advancing under its cover, got to within 50 metres of the Finnish shore when the fog lifted and the defenders' machine guns cut them down in heaps. The Finns still had astonishing successes, but Soviet numbers began to tell. By the second week in February, Finnish reinforcements consisted mainly of 16-year-old boys and reservists in their mid-50s. On the 14th of February, casualties in the Suma sector reached crisis point, and Mannerheim authorized a withdrawal. But with Suma gone, the remainder of the front was no longer viable. At 1600 hours on the 15th of February, Mannerheim ordered a general retreat back to an intermediate line, which was much less fortified. There were only two things which could save Finland: the spring and the intervention of foreign powers, particularly Britain and France. Unfortunately, the winter of 1939-40 was one of the coldest and longest of the 20th century. Foreign intervention was proving as illusory as the spring. Some foreign help had arrived, but it was in the form of semi-trained companies and battalions of idealistic volunteers, mainly from Sweden, but with contingents from many other European countries and the United States. On the 29th of February, Finnish diplomats had been on the point of accepting new Russian demands when an urgent message arrived from Paris. The French government urged Finland to fight on and promised the immediate dispatch of 50,000 troops and 100 bombers. On the strength of this promise, the Finns rejected Moscow's offer. But the French offer was dependent on the cooperation of Great Britain. And while Britain wished to send forces to Norway and Sweden to interfere with Germany's supplies of iron ore, London was not necessarily interested in going to Finland to fight the Russians. In addition, any Anglo-French intervention force destined for Finland was going to have to get the permission of the Norwegian and Swedish governments to cross their territory, and this was something Oslo and Stockholm were not prepared to allow. Finland made a desperate appeal to Norway and Sweden to open their borders, knowing that the appeal would be rejected. Finnish diplomats had already decided they had no choice other than to accede to Russian demands, and on the 13th of March signed a ceasefire in Moscow, which gave Stalin everything he had wanted. The Russo-Finnish War had lasted just 105 days. Finland had lost 25,000 dead and 43,500 wounded, out of a total population of fewer than 4 million. The Soviet losses were much greater, at least 250,000 dead, and about the same number wounded. The Finns took 5,000 Russian prisoners, a surprisingly low number that says much about the severity of the fighting. Though Finland had had to bow to the inevitable, she had earned a reputation as a formidable small power, a nation not to be meddled with. Conversely, even though the Soviets eventually succeeded, the reputation of the Soviet army as a fighting force had been destroyed. American and British observers rated the USSR as a third-rate military power, a hapless giant, incapable of defending itself. So too did the Germans. In fact, in April 1940, the Supreme Military Soviet met to sift through the lessons of the war and push through a program of radical reform. It was just in time.